When people talk about the struggles that men have today, I think one of the things we quickly focus on for men are feelings. I hear a lot of talk about this, and a lot of ways in which men are living between the times in terms of the whole business of expressing feelings, learning feelings, understanding feelings. We've been touting a couple of books. One of them is Daniel Levinson, The Seasons of a Man's Life. This is a book that was, Levinson's a psychiatrist who did a lot of research on the stages of a man's life. A good bit of his work was popularized in Gail Sheehy's book, Passages, that was a bestseller for a number of months several years ago. This is an excellent book, even though it's a reporting of his research. It's very readable, and there are a couple of copies left in the bookstore. Second book we're touting, we're really pushing this one, New Life for Men, a book that I wrote about 3 years ago with Ron Klug. I think the bookstore is out of them, however, and so when you return home, you can pick one up in pretty much, I guess, most Christian bookstores. It's published by Augsburg Publishing House. If you can't get one, you can write directly to the publisher. You could get one there. Or I'd be happy to send you one if you give me your address and $5 plus whatever postage is necessary to wherever you live. It's in the United States. But let's talk a little bit about this business of feelings then today, and how men are caught in the middle of change and caught between the times, as we were talking about on Monday, in terms of feelings. And I think I have what I like to call one of the best examples, I think, of how men are caught in the middle of change concerning feelings. As a baseball fan, I read the sports pages quite regularly, and about a year ago now, actually, I guess this was the summer of 85, I found two articles, not too many days apart, in the Chicago Tribune that I think really spell out what it means to be caught in the middle of change as far as feelings are concerned for men. Both of them involve baseball pitchers and their experiences. Let me read them to you. First one is from summer of 85, Chicago Tribune. Cardinals pitcher Danny Cox explained why he stiffed the media at a scheduled press conference last week in Los Angeles. "I knew what they were going to ask about," Cox told St. Louis Post-Dispatch writer Rick Hummel. Cox had been involved in a fist fight with his former brother-in-law last week in Georgia. "A lot of people came up to me and said I would have done the same thing," Cox said. "I wouldn't have changed anything about it." Cox said the man had threatened Cox's sister, mother, and brother before he punched him out. "A man's got to do what he's got to do," said Cox, who is 6'4" and 230 pounds. "If you wouldn't have, then you're not a man and you don't love your family." One way of being a man in today's world. Second article, again, summer of 85, Chicago Tribune. Minnesota reliever Ron Davis, you can tell this is a little bit dated, and Ron Davis is now a Chicago Cub. Minnesota reliever Ron Davis was driven to tears last Monday at Yankee Stadium after Don Mattingly hit a three-run homer off him to give New York a 9-8 victory. The Twins had blown an 8-0 lead, and Davis blew his cool afterward. "First time I ever cried about baseball in my life," Davis said. "I never thought it had happened to me. I saw Goose Gossage cry like a baby when he gave up a homer to George Brett in 1980 in the American League playoffs. No, cry like a person, like a human being." Minnesota fans reacted emotionally after reading about Davis's tears, and 22,500 welcomed him with a standing ovation when he entered Thursday's game against Detroit in the ninth inning with a 7-5 lead. Touched and surprised by the fans' sentiment, Davis responded with 3 strikeouts for his 6th save. "That was one of the brightest points in my career," he said. "I've been in World Series games and in All-Star games, but I never had an ovation like that." another way to be a man in today's world. Those kind of contrasting views, contrasting experiences for men, contrasting perspectives on the part of men is really what we mean when we talk about men today being caught in the middle of change, caught living between the times. Both are certainly ways of dealing with feelings. Both are certainly ways of expressing behavior, but you can perhaps even in your own reactions see how dramatically different one might be giving one reaction or the other. Imagine the reactions of other people to those kinds of feelings. So this is what I think it means, living between the times in terms of feelings. And you know, again, we talked last time about the fact that we're so much a either-or kind of society. We think it's supposed to be one or the other. You know, one way is better. If it's not this way, then it has to be this way. If it's this way, then it can't be that way. And really, of course, for men, what we're talking about is being able to both and. Not to necessarily punch people out and then go home and cry about it, but to be able to be appropriately assertive and to express strong feelings of anger, and yet to have the capacity to be sensitive and to have access to emotions and feelings that represent another side of that feeling spectrum. That when we're open to a whole range of feelings as men and as women, then we have a much greater capacity to lead a full and meaningful life. But why are feelings so difficult for men? I think we need to talk to that topic just a little bit before we also then involve you today in taking a look at some of your feelings, perhaps. We talk about the fact that the beaten path for men is this excessive need to control. We talked about the fact that that control exists or extends to the environment in terms of our world. We're constantly looking for ways to manage and shape and form the world and the environment, many times to its detriment. That control extends to other people. So often as men, we want to dominate the situation. We want to dominate the relationship. We want to dominate the social situation and shape it in a way, and the relationship in a way that we want it. And it also extends inward to self. That same control gets us in trouble in terms of our feelings, because we want to dominate and control and often suppress and repress feelings that are a very natural part of being a human person. Why do we do that? Well, it's not clear. Some people would argue that, and we heard a little bit of this discussion on Monday, that men just naturally think in a different way than women. That men tend to think, and there's a little bit of evidence that somehow the business of a certain kind of operation in the brain or a certain focus or development of the brain might be more of one direction for men and another for women. Men thinking more mathematically, more logically, women thinking more creatively and more flexibly. But there isn't a lot of evidence to support that kind of thing. There's a great deal more evidence to suggest that our culture, and the way we've been taught, and the way what we value as a society for men and women shapes us a lot more. There are a great many indications that feelings are unpredictable, or feelings are controlled by men because feelings are in this unpredictable realm. And the expression of feelings has been identified in our society as primarily a feminine characteristic. For men, then, the issue of feelings and getting in touch with feelings and expressing feelings and understanding feelings is often seen as a situation that they have little control in, and it is also seen as a situation in which these feelings are feminine, these feelings are unmasculine, and so one stays away from expressing those feelings. Perhaps the single most important lesson that we as men have to learn about feeling is that they cannot be controlled by suppressing or repressing them. And I want to talk then a little bit about control in feelings, but control of a different kind than is just characterized by suppression or repression. But let me talk a little bit about these terms. I was kind of playing with this the other day, and it looked to me like there were a number of words that sounded the same and that had the same shun ending that really could reflect a continuum of the way in which feelings can be expressed. So I've just put a few notes on the board from the point of view of creating some discussion here. And I see it going this way, with the arrow pointing upward from the bottom to the top of the chart, with the most effective communication coming as we move to the top of the chart. But let's start down on the bottom. What's on the bottom? Repression. A psychological term that essentially means pushing out, pushing away, denying, forgetting. When we repress something, what we apparently do is push it back to a point where we actually can forget it. Now this sounds a little bit magical, I suppose, unless you think about the fact that we all exist on at least two levels, to simplify it, a conscious level and a preconscious, or what has been called the unconscious level or subconscious level. And so we can operate up here, walking around in our daily lives, thinking and feeling and acting and responding, but we also have a part of our mind, a part of our experience that is largely unavailable to us at any one particular time. And in that storehouse are memories, experiences, feelings, situations that often have been pushed away. Sometimes they've simply been forgotten, whatever that process is, or sometimes they have been actually repressed, held back. This is too painful. I can't deal with this. One of the things that we see, for example, is many people have had early, very painful experiences. Put those experiences someplace very deep within inside themselves as a way of protecting themselves from the pain and the anxiety of those experiences. And often, not often, sometimes, in a psychotherapy situation, or sometimes just in a situation where one encounters an experience in their life, those feelings come back, and they come back often then in a very upsetting or a difficult way. But this is the minimal kind of way that anyone would deal with feelings, just to simply forget them. This results for others in a great deal of confusion, poor communication, and blocked intimacy, and for the individual, potential emotional problems, as I said, something we call in psychology and psychiatry somatization, which is a tendency to take one level of experience, feelings, for example, to repress them, and then to have them affect us and affect the body in a physical way, so that some people actually have what we call a psychosomatic illness, an illness that is more emotionally fueled than fueled physically by anything that is wrong with the body. Also, what can occur here are outbursts of feelings, where if we're not in touch with our feelings, if you want to say use that term, because we've pushed them so far down, then they can come out often in ways that are unpredictable. I think about men who are abusing men, who abuse their spouses and families. Often these are men who have repressed feelings of inadequacy and fear of personal inadequacy. Those repressed feelings come out in tremendous anger and hostility toward others, and in punishment toward others as a way of saying, look how powerful I am. The fuel for that behavior, though, if you work with these men, any of you who are in counseling or who have experienced have understood this, know that when these men are dealt with in therapy, if you can get them to therapy, you find frightened, inadequate feeling men at base, covered over with a tremendous armor of hostility and anger and rejection and distancing from other people, but underneath hurting men in their own way. And so this whole business of repression, probably the worst way that we can communicate feelings. Suppression is a conscious pushing down. This is a kind of an unconscious, I don't know what's in there kind of feeling, because it's so primitive and I pushed it down, it's so far down that I don't even know what's there. This is a, I don't want to think about it. Boy, do I feel weird or inadequate today, but I don't want to think about that. Let's go over here and have lunch. Or let's have a drink, or let's just do something. A covering over, a holding in, a holding down. These are very similar, but this is what we call much more conscious. This is a deliberate attempt. Let's not think about that today. Let's not talk about that. I don't want to get into that. And so many times from a feeling standpoint, if you'll see somebody who sees a very painful movie, and first of all, they'll often just avoid the painful movie. I know one man who says he hates to go to any kind of sensitive or upsetting movie. He just doesn't like what it does to him. He only goes to comedies and kind of westerns, you know, where things are very clear cut, but any kind of deep or thinking kind of movie is something that he doesn't like, because probably he's doing a lot of this, holding in feelings. Oftentimes I work with people in the office and they'll talk about something and I'll see their eyes begin to kind of just tear, not even tear, just kind of water a little bit. And then immediately they'll shut down and it'll go away. There'll be this kind of shade that's dropped over their face. That's a kind of suppression. Oftentimes I'll say to them, what are you feeling right now? And it's very confusing many times because they don't often know what they're feeling, because the process becomes so automatic. It's like, the minute I feel, I suppress, I push down, I stop. No, I don't change the subject. Many people change the subject dramatically at that time. And I'll say to them, why did you just change the subject? You're talking about this and now you've started to talk about this. Oh, did I change the subject? Yes. Well, then sometimes with that kind of help, somebody, people can get to where they're going with those feelings. Again, that results in a great deal of confusion and frustration for other people, because they see a little bit of it, but they don't understand what it is. It blocks intimacy. There's little intimacy in this area. And this is the complaint of so many women about their husbands. He won't talk to me. He won't talk about anything that's important. And oftentimes it's because as men, we tend to live in this area. We tend to live in holding in, controlling, keeping down. If you cry, then there's some, it's not just crying, but if you cry, that's bad. If you feel inadequate, then you're weak, you shouldn't feel that. All those admonitions, all those shoulds and oughts that have come out of our experience that tell us we're not supposed to be that kind of person, create this kind of thing for men and get them into a great deal of difficulty. One step higher, I think, is confession. And many men in the beginning will do this. The confession is a kind of letting loose, a dumping out, but it's a poorly focused expression of feelings, and it creates a good many problems also. It's a good start, it's somewhere to begin, but it creates uncertainty in others, it creates misunderstanding. What are you telling me? It can be overwhelming. When we confess and open up and dump feelings for the first time to other people, at Monday's group, somebody was talking about how she was tired of men who couldn't handle feelings. If she wanted a feeling relationship, they'd try that, and then it would just kind of all get mixed up. It can be overwhelming, it can be painful, but the potential for communication and the development of intimacy is here, because at least we're moving up the level of feelings. For the individual, there's a release, but there's often anxiety and guilt. Why did I say that? What did I do? What a terrible thing for me to be or to say or to express. But there is the opening up and the beginning of an unblockedness. Then there are, I think, two levels that are probably the most effective way to express feelings. We call them assertion and expression. I've got assertion a little bit lower here, because I think we can get into trouble with assertion too. Assertion I see as a kind of directed telling. And that's good. It's clearer communication, but there's potential for critical blaming in that. Sometimes when we're assertive, you know, it always reminds me of the movie, was it Network? It was about 10 years ago. It was about the situation where this, at least,
let's see, it was a big net, a big television kind of situation where this guy at one point sticks his head out the window. What I remember about the movie, sticks out his head out the window and he says, "I'm mad about this and I'm not going to take it anymore." Anybody see this movie? And then everybody begins kind of doing this. And that's kind of asserting feelings, but it also gets into sometimes a kind of critical blaming. The result for others certainly is awareness of the feeling and clarification of the other person's feelings, but it may create defensiveness and or emotional withdrawal. How many times have you been in a situation where someone's been very assertive about your about their feelings? Sometimes a tendency for us to kind of back up and say, gee, you know, okay, you know, I didn't know you felt that way. So assertion is good. I think we have to get to a point where we can assert our feelings. I'm not saying that it's all bad, but it has the potential to back people off emotionally and to create withdrawal. For the individual, increased sense of self and confidence, a feeling of being in charge, of learning about and getting to feelings, and direct communication. And then finally, expression, clarifying, saying, relating, and the more positive situations of greater intimacy at both levels for both the individual and for the person who they are communicating with. An incomplete chart, but just a kind of way of looking at what happens to feelings. In the book, we talk about a lot of the problems associated with suppression and repression, and I don't want to go into those in great detail, but there are many, many difficulties associated with holding in feelings and not learning how to express them in an appropriate way. One of them, again, at this level, is being really out of contact with a part of ourself and possibly being overwhelmed at some point in our life by feelings and impulses that we don't understand. A lot of potential for stress-related illnesses, the psychosomatic problems. Oftentimes, there have been some indication of things like ulcers and tension headaches, and even now some indications that maybe some major illnesses have to do with a breakdown of the immune system created by internal and external stress. When we can't manage our life, when we can't manage feelings and experiences well, and when we just kind of deny and distance ourselves from that part of us, it can lead to physical problems that create serious difficulties for people. Some of you may be familiar with Lawrence LaShawn's book, You Can Fight Back Against Cancer, where he actually talks about ways in which our emotional state and has identified some personality characteristics of some cancer patients that indicate that these are people who have suppressed and repressed and held in a great many feelings. Very preliminary kinds of things, and certainly not completely substantiated by evidence throughout medical science, but some early indications that personality and attitudes have a tremendous amount to do with illness and physical disease. So, lots of reasons why we need to learn how to express our feelings and to deal with feelings more effectively. And I do want to talk about, in a few minutes, some ways in which people can learn to express or learn to communicate feelings more effectively. But I would like to do something before that. I'd like to get you involved in a little bit here, and I'm going to pass out a sentence completion that's in the book, I think, but I have it on paper here. It's about 12 sentence stems that are associated with feelings. I'd like you to just take a few minutes and go through them. Let me pass them out, and you can just do this for yourself. You don't have to worry about sharing any of this information with anybody else, but I thought that it might be a way for you to kind of look at where you might experience ease or difficulty in expressing feelings. Let me just run through them. For those of you who might not
get one. If you're not interested in doing it, just pass it on to somebody else. Yeah. You have a book, that would be good. It's page 50, yes. It says, complete the following sentences with your own thoughts. Then rank them from 1 to 12, with 1 being the easiest to share with someone else, and 12 being the most difficult. It says, pay particular attention to any you have difficulty completing. What might that say to you? And then the list is, I am most proud of, I get angry when, I am happiest when, I feel nervous when, I get excited when, I feel safe when, I'm hurt when, I feel ashamed when, I feel loving when, I'm afraid when, I feel guilty when, and I feel discouraged when. If you just take a minute and just go through those, and if you have a pencil, write in the feeling. If you just want to think of the first thought that comes to your mind, that's okay too, and just kind of hold it in your mind. I'd just like you to have the experience of just kind of looking at some of your own reactions to those, and then we'll have a chance to talk a little bit about some of your thoughts and ideas, and also talk about what do we do with feelings and how do we express them, what are some specific ways to deal with them. While some people are doing that, any questions or any comments or any concerns so far? Yeah.
We went to the geology class with Rudy, and we spent a lot of time at the volcano, of course. And I think that bottom suppression is, if we have difficulty understanding that feeling, you can relate yourself to a volcano which sits there for years, or in our case, days, and all of a sudden it blows because it can't hold it any longer. And on the top, you might say Railroad Creek, where we can just let our feelings flow and dispense with these emotions. Am I on the right track?
What a beautiful analogy. I'm going to just kind of repeat it so that it gets on the tape. The response here was that suppression and repression are very much like a volcano, and having just come from a hike with Rudy Edmond about geology and volcanoes, this was a very clear analogy. I think that's absolutely correct, that at the bottom level of suppression and repression is the potential for this explosion, and that kind of turmoil that's always there but may not be obvious on the surface of the individual. And that at the top level of expression, it's kind of like Railroad Creek, and just let things flow, and there are a few rocks in there, and it gets to be some white water sometime, but there's some deep pools also with a very good analogy. Thank you. Dave?
View, though, maybe I should suppress this comment.
Absolutely no suppression allowed.
I do feel that perhaps the hierarchical ranking of these, with the ones at the top and the other at the bottom, is not quite right, because clearly, as it's obvious to everyone, is that there, in certain instances and in certain circumstances, the best way to handle certain emotions, normal, healthy psychological mechanism, is going to be repression or suppression. So that I wouldn't, I think that's a little misleading to make that seem like Nirvana if you're a Railroad Creek, and
I agree with you also, and I think that's, I'm glad you raised that. As I was putting that together, I made a mental note to myself to try to not to present this as this is all bad and this is the only way. The comment here is that that there are times when repression and suppression and confession are much more appropriate than assertion or expression. I think you're absolutely right. That we're really talking, again, not about whether or not one has all or none of these things, but what combination we have them in. Can anybody think of a situation in which repression is what we would call egocentric, helpful to a person?
In a catastrophe.
In a catastrophe. How would that be helpful?
Well, you'd help control the situation so there wouldn't be mob psychology.
Right. Yes. And in a personal catastrophe also, individuals who have experienced abuse, for example, to always live completely, totally, with the feelings of shame and hurt and fear and anger that would be a part of that situation, to not have the way to forget some of that would be a terribly painful experience for us as people. So, very good point, Dave. This is not to say that that this is completely bad. It's just that if that's all we do with feelings, if we take every feeling or the majority of our feelings and push them down and suppress them and hold them in, we're going to get into trouble. But it acts as a kind of an emergency stopgap. Even so, though, when we've repressed or when an individual's repressed these very painful experiences, it's almost as if there's a certain amount of room in there, and you can only do so much of that. And in a trauma, personal or global, or whatever, community, repression, suppression, holding down, holding in, is an effective way for a while. It is not an adaptable way for the long haul, typically. And there are times when you shouldn't express your feelings. I mean, my gosh, if you told everybody everything that you ever thought and felt, I mean, have you ever had anybody do that? There are people who do tend to seem to do that, and they're pretty tiring, you know? Come on, give me a break. You know, turn off for a while. And I think this is where sometimes we get into trouble, you know, as we talk about these things with men and women. They say, well, gee, you know, do I have to say everything? Do I have to be... turn into a mad hugger, you know, where I'm always hugging and expressing feelings. Well, no, again, we're not talking about that, but we're talking about for the fact that for most men, they could really benefit by moving up the continuum here. They don't have to live up here, but, you know, vacation here once in a while. Visit. You know, take a day off and go and see what it's like over on the other side of the mountain. And so many times for us as men, we don't do that. Yeah. Another question? No.
I have a thought. Working with my children when they're small, you know, it's very easy to tell them to talk their feelings through. As they grow older, they're getting so much influence from society. You know, I know, especially with my son now, he's preteen, and he's picking it up that he's not supposed to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a man doesn't do that. You know, he's, which is not necessarily the attitude in the home. But it's like, how do you, kind of counterbalance this?
Mm-hmm. The question is, how do you to deal with a boy or a girl growing up, and despite the fact that in your home you might be communicating a certain kind of thing, and maybe even modeling a certain kind of thing, that society impacts on us too. And Ron Davis is still probably the exception to go in the clubhouse and cry after he gives up a home run. I don't think that's standard behavior for major league pitchers. But a couple of things to remember about that. One is that especially young people, kids go through periods of change. And I would think a junior high boy especially is going to have an awfully difficult time being a new male, you know, expressing feelings and dealing with them. I mean, it's just not going to work. That's a difficult time, I think, for all kids. They're really in the process of kind of finding themselves. The peer group is very important. What your friends say and what they do, you know, you want to fit in. You can't fight that battle, and I don't think you really need to. I think what happens, though, is if in your home you model the behaviors that you're interested in, those will come through. Somebody was saying yesterday that... terms of church education, that if you have a hypothetical 1,000 units of influence on a kid, that the parents have, is it the parents have 450?
550.
And the church has, what, 10 or 2?
Two.
Was that it? So it's in that home. that we learn. And that's both the salvation and the chaos for us, because it's in the home and in our relationships with our parents that we've been taught our attitudes and feelings, but we're taught both good and bad. And so if you're modeling the behavior that's appropriate, if you're talking with, not talking at, but showing the expression of those feelings, he'll pick up on those. And I think he will use those and integrate them in his own way. But he's going to be influenced by the peer group too. Third thing is you could take heart in the fact that many psychologists say that by the time the child is 5 or 6 years of old, or 6 years of age, a major personality has been formed anyway. And so from that point on, you're fighting a losing battle. And the peer group is too. You got to keep in mind, you know, with kids, or really with all of us, something that's always been kind of consoling to me when I can think of it during difficult times is the final chapter hasn't been written yet. And we can be in the middle of a situation with a child or a spouse or ourselves and feel pretty frustrated with it, but we have to see that we're in process. Family and growth is in process, and salvation is in process too. Any other contributions, thoughts? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I have one. Do you have any hints or ideas or suggestions on dealing with, she alluded to her son or her children? How about men who are beginning to learn to speak this emotional language or becoming familiar with it, dealing with their fathers who don't speak it at all, and trying to make peace as their fathers go into the winter of their lives, mm-hmm. and some of the, you know, unresolved things that have occurred intergenerationally. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's
now the question is, how do men who have maybe kind of come to this on their own go back and deal with their fathers who may not be coming from this perspective at all? That's a tough question for me for a couple of reasons. One is, I don't have experience with my father, with me being older. My father died when I was 18, and I really don't know how to relate to that, because I don't do that, I guess. And so much of my own sense of awareness, I think, has come out of my own experiences, and so I'm a little stuck with that. But I'd say this, though, too, you know, we can't change anybody directly. And so many times we want to go into a situation and make somebody different than what they are. And I always would want to caution people about, even though we feel like we've found the way, it's awfully hard sometimes to show somebody else that way. And so I would say, try to meet your father on your terms and his terms, rather than trying to convert him. Sometimes when we, again, model the behavior, and when we live the behavior, and when we don't shy away from that behavior, they can respond to that in their own way. But it's unlikely that at that point we'll change him into something different. I know the thing that I tend to do, I think, with older men, with my father-in-law and with other people, is that I tend to try to fit into their experience, maybe too much. And they want to tell those stories, I'll sit and kind of listen to them and agree with them. And I often don't share probably enough of myself. When I do, I think they learn from that. I know one time I talked with my father-in-law about my own faith and my experience with Jesus Christ. And he had a hard time with that, I think, but I think he heard it, you know, and I think he could hear that. And I don't know that he completely agreed with it or that he that he fully understood it, but that was a little bit unusual for me. My typical way would just be to be quiet and just kind of live on his terms. So I think we do have to share that part of ourselves. I don't know if that's helpful, but that's as good as I can do.
Yeah, I've been teaching my son for 35 years, and now he's going to teach me, huh?
Well, I think we all...
You know, I'm just saying that.
Yeah, but we all do have something to learn from one another. And
yeah, but that, what I'm saying is, if you teach a person for 35 years, now you're going to, you know, he's supposed to teach you, that's pretty hard, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's not easy. Him to tell me.
Okay.
Him to tell me.
Okay, here's a dad with a son. how would you, how would you want him to respond to you? If I were your son and I were talking about these ideas, how would I, what would you want from me in a relationship?
I guess I don't want anything.
Would you want me to share who I am and where I'm coming from with these things if you didn't disagree, or if you didn't agree with them, or would you just want me to kind of stay quiet? And I mean, if I had a very different perspective than you did, you're my dad, you've, you know, raised me, and I came out of one family, on the other hand, one kind of experience, on the other hand, I've kind of grown and changed and made my own way. I want to bridge the gap with you, I want to have a relationship with you. How do I do that for you? How would that work?
Well, that's what I, that's what I'm saying. That is hard to accept. It's not easy, is all I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
You want to listen, but you, some reason or other, you can't really agree. For some reason, if, you know, you've been teaching him all this time, it's hard.
It's hard to get out of the dad role, the father role, and the son role.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, easy.
Uh-huh. Pride gets in the way.
Pride is everything.
But wouldn't you want you and I to be able to share with one another, to really kind of get to know each other on an adult-to-adult level?
Definitely, you want to. I'm not saying you don't want to.
Okay.
But it isn't easy. It just...
But how do I do that? Do I invite you to a men's support group with me, or do I...
I don't know.
Do I send you an autographed copy of my book, or what?
I don't know whether it's a way.
Okay.
I mean,
you know, anybody else have a thought about that? Other, yeah.
I might be able to contribute to that. I've got the same situation. My son is 44, and I'm 30 years older than he is. And for a long time now, we've had separate ways, separate lifestyles. And all of a sudden, turns out that he's having family problems, which we were suspicious of because communication was lacking all the way along the line, both in his family and between him and me. About 3 months ago, he tells me unexpectedly that he's going to leave his wife. And I said, for goodness sake, what's happening? He says, well, it turns out that I've been uncommunicative with my family without knowing it. And I thought to myself, boy, this is old stuff for me because I haven't talked to my son for a long time on a personal basis.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I don't know what to do about it because I've been living this way for a long time, as you well know. In fact, I don't know when I've ever said, Dad, I love you. I can't say that. It's difficult for me to open up this way, and my wife tells me that she's had the same problem with me all these years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's too bad that a guy goes into a 23-year-old marriage with this feeling and three kids that are sensitive to this. And I don't want to get too personal with this, take all day, but there is a lesson to be learned between father and son. They should communicate no matter what, just like he and his wife should have opened up, both college graduates, but still couldn't communicate and talk.
Yeah.
And I think that's a pity.
Yeah.
Makes me jump up and down inside because it's too late now, and I doubt if it'll ever be reconciled, but it could have happened earlier.
I feel the pain of that situation, but I do not think it's too late. The fact that your son has talked to you, even in the way that he has, and that you have the sensitivity that you do to the situation, to me is an open, at least a crack in the door to that communication. The challenge now is, how do you keep it going? You know, how do you break through and get the door wider? And I think what you've said is what you have to do, and that is, it has to happen. You know, you have to talk. You have to say what's inside.
I opened up now because there's a lot of fellas in this room who are in the middle age area who might have that suppressed feeling that I just expressed. And boy, don't let it go on. Get that guy in the corner and say, let's talk.
Yes.
Because he might need that in his own lifestyle.
Yeah, he might be waiting for that.
Right. It's a shame that you can't, you know, open up.
Well, I have somewhat similar situation with my daughter, and I think the whole crux of the matter, hopefully, is her accepting me as a human being and my accepting her as a friend instead of this daughter-mother relationship, if we can accept each other as imperfect human beings mm-hmm. and become friends,
mm-hmm.
and how that will ever happen, I don't know, but I'm praying for that.
Moving, Pat and I are going to talk next week about expecting or accepting, not expecting, and that's what you're talking about, I think. How can we, as adult father, son, mother, daughter, whatever, move from the expectations to the acceptance of the individual? And so much of the parent-child relationship is what I expect of you, what I want from you, what I want you to be. So much of an adult relationship is accept. Yeah. How can I see you for who you are, and you can see me for who I am, and we don't have to fight about that anymore.
Or compete.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think another issue on that main is that parents often assume the teacher role, as you were talking about, and the kid is the student. And I think we impose that. I think what I'm beginning to understand, my own relationship with my daughters, is to be thankful the times that they teach me and tell them about it. He taught me something along the way. We learn from each other.
Yeah.
I think I've learned to express myself in letters to my kids, my grandkids now.
Excellent. You know, we use an example of this in the book. It wasn't my example, it was Ron's, but he writes in the book about a man that he knows who every week sits down and writes a letter, a personal letter to his family. And he just kind of writes about himself and what's going on and what he's doing, and as kids are gone now. But he sends them. He stays in touch by letter. And many men are better at this than direct face-to-face kind of thing. Try putting your thoughts down on paper. Try writing to your son some of the thoughts and feelings that you have felt over the years that you've held in. Sometimes that can open up, you know, that kind of communication.
I'm glad he said that, because in dealing with my mother and father, they write us every several weeks or so, but we always use the phone. And for our generation, the phone is the common way of communicating. I mean, by the time you sit down and write a letter, you know, and the time investment and all that sort of stuff, you can call on the phone. But the point is that for that generation, the method of communication that they understand and use is the letter. And so for us in the in our midlife, maybe that's a real good clue that we can use that to, as this gentleman said, to communicate with our
you know, I think a letter is far more powerful, because when somebody writes and says, you know, I just want to tell you how much I have loved you and not been able to say all these years, you can read that 50 times. You hear that once on the phone and it's gone, and you want to hear it again, and it feels good, but and you want the person to say it again, but what do you say? Well, tell me you love me again? You know, you can't say that.
We got a letter like that from our son for Father's and Mother's Day both recently, and it was beautiful. And he usually uses the phone too. But this letter, we will treasure forever, because it was just
wonderful. It not only helped them, but it helps me to express myself too.
Sure.
And to understand my own
thinking. To say things in a letter that are maybe difficult to give across the conversation.
I want you all go over to the village store and buy a postcard from Holden Village today. Send it to one of your adult children, all of your adult children. Tell me you were in a group today that was talking about feelings, and one of the feelings that you got in touch with was the fact you really care about them.
You can't phone them from here.
That's right. You can't phone. There are no phones. That's why there are no phones in Holden Village, because they're a lousy way to tell somebody you love them.
I think that's one of the keys of the marriage encounter movement, too. Alice and I learned that.
Yes. That's right. Marriage encounter, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is basically a form of communication that's centered around writing and dialoguing on paper, with paper and pencil, between couples, and that communication is positive. Keep this in mind about negative feelings, though. Be very careful about putting negative feelings in a letter, because they can read those 100 times, too. You know, you dump all those feelings and get all that stuff out, and they save that letter in the bottom of a drawer somewhere, and it just kind of...
Letters are also kind of a diary for future generations. not just the current generation, but if they're saved, then future generations.
Yeah. Right.
Understand.
I have a letter that my dad wrote my mother back in 1916. I framed it because it was apologizing to my mother for the only argument they ever had. That's a fact. They never argued. But this particular argument, I won't go into detail on why it was. It has nothing to do with a church connection. But he wrote a most beautiful letter, and I've got it up on top of my shelf file with the frame around it because it's a precious document.
Yes, it really is. And I have one written communication from my father that is in, and I don't even know if I know where this book is anymore, but it's in an eighth grade autograph book. Remember when you have an autograph book where people sign, my father signed the autograph book and wrote a little note to me. He wasn't a communicator, basically verbally or written wise, but that's a treasure to me, just to know that that was written, to see his hand and the pen and the message. Even though the message was one that has gotten me into a lot of trouble, but it's still important to me.
I think letters can be less threatening. We have a teenager that it seems like to verbally apologize or communicate is a means losing pride or giving in. But all of a sudden there will be a letter or a note appear. This is something she's developed on her own, and she can communicate or apologize or whatever in a letter, and mm-hmm. it's like she doesn't have to lose so much of herself to write it down and mm-hmm. verbally say it. Mm-hmm. So I think some of these are less threatening.
Yes. I've kept a journal off and on, and many times on at least one occasion I wrote about my pastor, who has been very influential in my life, and who actually got me to Holden Village and got us to Holden Village the first time, and believe it or not, got me to the writer's conference where I met Ron Klug and wrote the book. So, I mean, he just has just stimulated my life and moved my life in so many meaningful ways. And I wrote about it in my journal, and I just took the page out and made a copy of it, and I sent it to him. And I think he really appreciated just those kind of spontaneous thoughts. It wasn't a letter to him. I just said, I thought you might want to see this. I wrote this in my journal yesterday. So that's the kind of thing you do, too.
I think you have to think also about whether you're going to send a letter or not. I know that for my father, he has written me reams and reams. And every time I see, post, you know, that letter from him, I'm like, oh,
here it comes again.
You know, I was 2 days old and he started writing to me about notebooks. And then when I was having, like, emotional troubles when I was early 20s, he would write and write and write about what that's doing to the family, and but how much I love me, and but how much it's hurting him to see me go through this. And those just felt smothering and heavy to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more of a wound than it.
Yeah, I could see that. And again, it's an indication, isn't it, how what we do, this whole business of writing letters, can be good or bad, depending on how we do it. You know, it can be helpful or not so helpful. And that whole business of moderation and finding a balance in that is so very important, because that kind of letter maybe set up all kinds of expectations and put pressure on you to be or to do a certain kind of thing, and it wasn't the kind of letter that was beneficial. And yet, there is power in others that can be very, very beneficial. Well, I wanted to, though, get a chance. Anybody have any reaction to the thing you did here? One of the things we talked about, for example, in the book, as we talked with a number of men in writing the book, were that there were certain feelings that men had the most difficulty with. And I'd be curious if any of the men here are willing to share which ones were the most difficult for them, if you rank them as we suggested that you did. In talking with men, we found that three kinds of feelings were the most difficult. One was anger, that many of the men that I talked with in writing the book had a great deal of difficulty with feelings of anger. They did not know what to do with those feelings. The second feeling that they had difficulty with was fear. And for many men, it seemed to be a fear of failing, a fear of being weak, a fear of not being able to do something. Fear of failure, I think, was the strongest connotation. And the third fear that many men had was a fear of attraction to other women, fear of sexual feelings, that these feelings would get them into trouble or that they would have difficulty with. Anybody want to share what feelings were most difficult for them here? Or?
I put down, I'm afraid when I'm on the freeway.
So you're afraid when you're... You're in California?
Yeah.
Yes.
now they're shooting at
us. You have a bulletproof car? Yeah.
No.
Okay, any others? Anything, which ones did you rank as the most difficult? Which feeling? Did anybody do the assignment? We have to have you turn these in later. Okay, maybe you just don't have thoughts about that.
Did you do any work with women in preparation for your book or anything else? I'm curious about the one about guilt. I've met more women who have an incredibly large ability to feel guilty.
Yeah, I didn't really talk with women about the book. We did have, which I think was very good and something I almost didn't do, we did have some women read the book in its first draft, and it was very helpful. Of course, Pat is reading it all along and telling me where I was going wrong, but we got we got some women to read the book, and one of the things that they said was that the number of the examples some of our comments were kind of sexist about women, and so we went back and tried to look at those and got good feedback about it, but it didn't get any real input from them around feelings or around this topic, if that's what you were asking.
So I was just curious about women and guilt, I guess. I've done a lot of thinking about that. Our culture somehow allows women to just wallow in guilt. And somehow the sexist part of our culture, I think, just gives every opportunity for women to feel guilty, but I don't see that as much in men. I don't know if it's just they don't express it or...
Yeah. I think I would tend to agree with you in general that maybe guilt would be a bigger or a more common feeling for women than men, but I don't know. Have to start interviewing some women. Yep.
In support groups, they have the philosophy of choosing how you feel. Now, when you choose how you know I can feel, I can choose to feel angry, or I can choose to feel guilty. However, with talking to myself and saying, well, by feeling guilty, that's unproductive, and let's not choose to feel guilty because it's unproductive. Would you say this has suppression? Would this be suppression or repression if you choose not to feel guilty, if you choose not to be resentful?
Question is, can we choose our feelings,
yeah.
and if we're choosing them, is it repression? I've never had success at choosing my feelings. I have had more success at, and this is maybe a man's way, but I've had more success at trying to understand the thinking behind the feeling. We didn't get into it, but there's a whole school of thought, Albert Ellis and rational emotive kind of psychotherapy, believes, and many contemporary psychologists, cognitive psychologists and cognitive psychology believe that thinking creates feelings. The old way was that feeling creates thinking. You know, that you feel a certain way, and that feeling just happens, and then that creates a certain attitude or thought. Actually, the reverse seems to be true. And that, if that's the case, if you believe that that's the case, then it's very helpful, I think, in terms of understanding feelings. So if you're feeling something, if you're feeling guilty, it's helpful to think about what is it that I'm thinking, or what experience have I had, how am I interpreting the world or this experience that's happened to me to create guilt? But to just say, I choose not to feel depressed, I can't do that. Because I get depressed sometimes, and it's part of it, I feel like I can't get out of it. Another part of it, I feel like it's kind of nice to be here and just be depressed and I don't want to do anything about it. But I think it's hard to choose without understanding where the feeling's coming from.
Well, support groups call that wallowing.
Yeah, see, right. You know, I like to wallow a little bit.
Yeah.
I want to be healthy all the time.
If I feel resentment toward a person and realize that by feeling that resentment, I am allowing that person to control me because I am feeling resentment.
Uh-huh.
I am that person's slave.
Mm-hmm.
If he's making me resentful, and I just wonder if that is healthy or if that is, you know, as I asked.
I wouldn't call that repression or suppression. I'd call it, actually, it would be another term we call intellectualization.
Okay.
But there again, that's helpful too,
yeah,
to intellectually try to understand the feelings. You know, it seems like a contradiction to think about feelings, but I think ultimately this, or an effective blending of these, is really a kind of intellectual exercise, that we're trying to deal with feelings, but we're trying to deal with them in a way that that shapes them and expresses them appropriately and adequately. And so I would call that more thinking about or intellectualizing about the feeling. You can do that too much, too. You can intellectualize away feelings. All you can do is think about it and analyze it, and pretty soon you don't have any feelings then either. You know, the challenge is, how do we blend the thinking and the feeling in our life so that we have some semblance of balance? This is, you know, all one level, and this is all another. Kind of moving back and forth between these where appropriate, and blending them is where we're coming from. But I think our time is up today, and we'll be talking more about these areas later in the week. Thanks for coming.